Welcome to What's Left, a weekly political discussion challenging the mainstream left. I'm Andy Libson, and today we have kind of a special guest, but kind of a person who's been here regularly, Kenny Zepeda, who has agreed to step in for Eduardo.
Yeah. While he travels in Europe.
Yes, he's on his way to Spain.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he's going to go to France. So today, do you know what we're going to talk about, or you're going to find out right now, as I say?
I think I will find out, more or less. I mean, I have a rough idea.
Yeah. Since Kenny's been a regular guest here, and since Kenny himself has taken a bit of a political journey from, I think, a little bit more liberal beginnings, to becoming a revolutionary, becoming a socialist, and I would not be surprised if Kenny is going to be more on this program. Like, me and Eduardo have talked about you stepping in for me sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, so I think it'd be worth, what I want to do in this episode is sort of kind of walk through the steps of where you started from politically, and where you ended.
Yeah.
So that's my goal. I know that you said, well, you want to ask me some questions, but
I might, we'll
okay, see. All right. but you may ask me no questions, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, all right. So does that sound good to you?
Sure. Great.
Okay,
all right. Let's do this.
So I guess what I would ask is sort of your background. Say a little bit about where you were born, where you come from, and really say anything about it, but maybe some of the things that you think about that might have informed where you started politically and where you ended politically.
Yeah. So, I was born in Guatemala, and one of two. My mother...
How long ago?
This is 1987, so okay. I'm 32 years old. I grew up in Guatemala, close to a market, one of the most probably like dangerous areas in the Guatemala City. A lot of commerce, prostitution, you know, alcohol, drugs, petty crime, merchants, you know, farmers coming from the outside of the country, you know, like farmers bringing their products to the market.
And where specifically in Guatemala?
So Guatemala City is the La Terminal. It's like where it's a bus terminal.
Okay.
And a lot of looks, you know, the chicken buses, you know, the people know them as. They used to come to that market. And I saw, you know, people from all over the country hustling to make a living.
Mm-hmm.
And I myself grew up in a motel. My mother ran that place. And, you know, she was not... She didn't own the place, she rented, she paid rent. And so she charged for some people to live there. They rented rooms, working class people.
Mm-hmm.
There was also prostitution, you know, sex workers that just came and did their business, rented the room. So I grew up around, you know, condoms and birth control since I was a little kid.
Mm-hmm.
At times just running the business at the door with my mom.
And how old would you have been when you're being part of this business?
So I actually moved to that hotel when I was like 3 months old. So until I came to the United States when I was 12.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, throughout my mother being a single mother, she, you know, had to, living in a men's world, hustle and fight back and literally physically fight people at times.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, always stepping in for people. That's why I mentioned this, because I think it's relevant for my political views. You know, my mother never openly or clearly stated that she was a socialist or a revolutionary, but she fought for justice. You know, mm-hmm. she fought abusive men that try to, you know, like a cop, you know, tried once to, threatening his sex worker partner, and my mother just took the gun away from the cop.
Wow.
And she punched a man on the face for, you know, trying to be abusive. Mm-hmm. And
so he was like a superhero before, without a costume.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think of my mother as a philanthropist, social worker. She never went to college. She was a teacher, but it's the equivalent of being a high school graduate.
Mm-hmm.
Here. So she did graduate from high school. But yeah, she led by action and she stepped in for people. And so yeah, that's important because mm-hmm. I think at the same time, my mother, even though she never openly again stated any political positions, she would listen to revolutionary music. That is omnipresent in my life growing up. You know, we would go to sleep and revolutionary music from Venezuela that talked about, you know, dispossession, you know, give the voice to the poor. And, you know, that music is more of a nationalist, you know, approach to, mm-hmm. you know, the empire, the U.S. empire. So this language has been around in my life the whole time.
Right. And what was going on in Guatemala at that time? Like, it's had a number of, you know, movements to try to push out U.S. strong men and things like that. What was taking place at that time in Guatemala?
So during my experience, I mean, I recall conversations of adults talking about privatization and seeing that as a bad thing. And I obviously didn't understand. I was, you know, my formative years. And so, but definitely that was around, you know, they privatized, I remember the telephonic company, you know, the mm-hmm. telephone company. Mm-hmm. And, you know, obviously years later, I figure out that is the IMF and these, mm-hmm. you know, structural adjustment programs, deep in their hand. And, you know, there was some unrest, but, the legacy of the repression in Guatemala, left a lot of people weary of the political participation because yeah. it ended in murder. You know, you would disappear, and so yeah. I mean, mm-hmm. that's those are my formative years. Again, a mother that stood up for people and listened to revolutionary music.
Yeah, yeah,
and yeah.
And so, what then brings you to the United States? Does it just bring you and your mother? What forced you to make that journey?
So my grandmother was the trailblazer, even though it's a long story, but basically my mother didn't grow up with her mother on a random chance encounter. My mother reconnects through some random person on the street, reconnects with her family, and then finds out that her mother is in the United States. Turns out that my dad had come to the United States under asylum. He was a cop, he was a police, and he was applying for asylum. I mean, there was a lot of stuff that happened down there. I don't know the details.
Yeah,
that's another aspect of, I think, the heritage or the lack of, you know, of knowledge of the past, because obviously there's a reason my dad came here, but I don't know that story because... Right. Again, that history of repression and things that, you know, hush-hush, you don't talk about them. And, you know, especially, obviously, combined with machismo and, mm-hmm. you know, internalizing these things. So there are many things of my dad's side that I don't know. I mean, but he's still important, you know, because he himself was a military man during the wars, during the Civil War, you know, where the leftist armed groups were fighting against, you know,
the government.
Yeah,
but he would have been a government soldier.
Yeah. And so I have had conversations, that's probably later, mm-hmm. but you know, about that period and mm-hmm. being able to dig out a little bit. But yeah, so at that time, again, the 80s 90s, that's when I was growing up, that's when a lot of these structural adjustments were taking place. Mm-hmm. And obviously we grew up in a dictatorship. I didn't know, like, I remember in school, in middle school, learning about voting, because, you know, Guatemala was governed by...
Middle school...
In Guatemala,
okay.
So I was like, what? Actually, maybe elementary school, but teaching us what voting was. And not until later did I realize that we were governed by military men for many years. And that's... I was born in that, mm-hmm. you know, context. Yeah, I mean, and then we ended up in the United States through my grandmother, who had come here illegally many years ago, but she was able to, you know, fix her status and brought us over, reconnected with my dad, and then went to school here.
Is there anything special that happened during that journey, or was it, you know, something that not particularly memorable? From going from Guatemala.
States. I mean, it's impactful. I mean, actually, as of November this year, so it's been 20 years since we moved here. So we remember the day, the date, and the time. Because it's not a small thing, you know, to become an immigrant, you know, the other, learn a new language, and figure out things. And I think that's where my political journey started, you know, in trying to figure out who I was.
Because when you arrived here or starting with that journey?
Okay. When I arrived here, obviously I was 12, became a teenager, went to middle school in San Francisco, high school in San Francisco, but throughout that time and in college, you know, I went, ended up in Berkeley. We can talk about details, but UC Berkeley. But so obviously trying to figure out, learn the language first, assimilate, you know, going through the struggles of any immigrant, or at least working class, lower class immigrant. You know, we came to live in a room with three other people. So it was my brother, my mother, and three other people. And then in the house, there were there was another family. So it was like 15 to 20 of us with one bathroom, one kitchen. And it was a complete change because my mother, obviously in Guatemala, running that business, had a self-determination. You know, she had control of, you know, to a degree. Obviously, she had to still pay rent and make ends meet. But we also employed, you know, like a person that helped around the house in Guatemala or the hotel. She was an indigenous woman. That's another aspect of growing up in Guatemala that kind of has shaped my politics.
Can you say more about that?
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know if I'm going to hit the numbers exactly. I mean, people can check them. But Guatemala has a high native indigenous population. I think it's like 40% identify as native indigenous.
And does that group speak Spanish or is it
They speak different languages. Sometimes they don't even understand each other. Okay. It's also a misconception that to think that, you know, they're one thing, you know, they're, there are 25 dialects, I think, in Guatemala. So like 23 indigenous Spanish and like, you know, it's also like a small diaspora of African Americans, African, Latin, you know, African diaspora. And, but yeah, the dominant identity issue in Guatemala is the separation of, you know, whether you're indigenous or you're not. And there's a word they call the non-indigenous, Ladinos. You know, that's a mestizo, you know, a person that's of mix, whatever. But despite indigenous Guatemalans or, you know, the original peoples, being 40% of the population, they don't have political power. And so that was one of the aspects that pushed a lot of peasants to declare war on the state, you know, different army groups, because again, capitalism came in and imposed private property on, you know, people that are used to communal arrangements. And, you know, obviously corruption, you know, and the military being the powers that actually rule, they enrich themselves while, you know, dispossessing the people at the bottom.
But your father was indigenous?
Well, that's the thing, you know, we are not, I wouldn't say our people are indigenous, my family. We don't identify as indigenous, we definitely have blood. It's a little complicated. And again, we don't practice, so I've never felt, you know, that I can claim that because I've never practiced the customs and the understanding. I don't even, you know, just think I'm discovering. And so, yeah, there's definitely, you know, like indigenous Maya blood in our family.
Right. But you sort of said that you feel like your political journey really maybe begins once you arrive here in the United States, or at least your awareness of political ideas.
Yeah, and connecting the dots, you know, putting, you know, digging back to the past and understanding my experience, that was the goal. You know, that's what, I mean, after I was able to get my feet on the ground, you know, on a solid base, you know, when I was able to communicate, you know, then I was able to, and push in a way to apply to college, you know, and got accepted to UC Berkeley. And that's, I think, when my political journey started moving faster.
Okay, let's go backwards to more like, so you arrive here, you go to middle school and high school, or just high school here in the United States?
Middle school for a year and a half, and then all of high school.
Yeah, and you went to Mission High, which is where I taught as well. And I was one of your teachers.
You were, yes. Number 25.
According
to him.
So what about that time when you're in high school, middle school? Well, how would you describe that period of your life in terms of your development in any way?
Yeah.
In terms of how you did, how you're growing?
I mean, they were, it was interesting because like I said, we were like lower middle class in Guatemala because my mom could afford private school for us.
In Guatemala?
In Guatemala.
Not in the United States?
Not in the United States. Yeah. Obviously here we come and we can't afford anything. You know, we were living in a room, and depending on the income of my father, then my mom starts working, gets injured. So it takes time for us to get going. And during high school, going to public school, you know, in being exposed to all sorts of, you know, backgrounds. People that are all right, people that are not so all right, homeless kids, you know, people from other ethnic groups, you know. And so, again, there's a lot, that's what I mean by trying to find my identity or find a solid footing, because everything was moving at that time. You know, I was still discovering the language and the nuances of, you know, culture and, you know, like references. So, you know, that was all in high school, you know. And, you know, little accidents threw me into classes that allowed me to do better, you know, in relative terms, you know, to my other...
Can you say more about that?
Yeah, so like, you know, honors classes. So I was supposed to be in ESL classes, and...
English is second language. Where the classes move a little slower, but the emphasis is on learning English.
Yes, and I always thought since middle school, obviously in middle school, I think the year and a half in middle school was a waste of time. I was treated as if I was dumb, even though I probably had a better education than most of these kids at the time, especially like in math. You know, like usually I think you find that in foreign countries, you learn better math skills. So that is all not considered, really. You are thrown into these remedial classes, you know, trying to get you up to speed, but in reality, you're not moving, at least at the time. I can't speak for now, but I wasn't learning. I think it was, in retrospective, it was a waste of time. Yeah, so again, high school, different backgrounds, and you know, some kids are in gangs. I'm playing soccer, I'm staying busy, and you know, I see this, you know, despite my mother having to work two jobs after my dad was deported, actually, because he stopped applying for asylum. It was too expensive. Couldn't afford it, you know, earning minimum wage.
So your father was deported back?
From the, yeah.
Okay.
So
you all had come over?
My mother, my brother, and I did because of my grandma.
Okay.
And then we reconnected with our dad.
Okay.
And then... eventually, you know, he was deported. We came here legally.
Yeah.
And so we tried, my mother tried to help him. And then he had a deportation order, long story short. They they cited him, or they gave him an appointment at the immigration offices. And when they sit down, they swarm my mother and my dad. My mom freaks out. My dad is taken into custody. Saw him behind, you know, the plexiglass, handcuffed, you know, from the waist, ankles, and hands, as if he was like a, you know, murderer. Well,
how old are you at this point?
I was probably 14.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
Yeah, 12, 14 or 15. So I was in high school. And so, yeah, that was obviously also very formative, you know, or impactful, you know, seeing my dad in that, you know. And then he was forced to sign a... you know, his deportation order, you know, because he was put in these horrible conditions. You know, mind you, this is 2002.
Right.
You know, like, yeah.
What I think you mean is that you can either stay in these rotten conditions and rot here in this jail, or you can agree to your deportation. We'll send you back.
Exactly. And so most people, or a lot of people, because they don't know their rights, they end up signing that deportation order.
Right. And so it's like, oh, you agreed to this.
Yeah. Especially because it also becomes an issue of money. Because he was offered basically like parole until he leaves the country. Mm-hmm. But he would have to pay his own way back. And, you know, so he did the math and he came down to, I'll just take a free ride with the U.S. Marshals.
Right. Otherwise, if we give you parole, we're going to charge you for your plane ride back.
Oh, he has to go and buy it and prove that he bought it.
Okay.
And at the time, that's what I remember.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And this all happened in high school, same time, you know, being pushed and groomed to... You know, because I had good grades, I was playing soccer, I was taken under the wing of the athletic director, mm-hmm. you know, Mr. Kennedy.
Yep.
Mission High School didn't have a good reputation when I first started. I did not want to go there. Mm-hmm. I applied to other schools.
What did you hear, and what was your reason for not wanting to go there?
Gangs, weed, you know, in the holes, and I got these horrible stories and these, bad kids, basically, you know, and, but my brother went there, and he went there from 1 year, 1.5 years. And so I was assigned there. I did not want to go, but I didn't know any better. I didn't know what was good. I didn't know, you know, how to apply. So I was in the system and up to their, you know, decision of what.
And if you had, at the time, you would have fought for going to a different school or something like that.
Probably, yeah. Okay. I mean, but again, we're sorting things out at the moment. You know, my dad is deported. Actually, I'm already in high school, but he didn't even know. My dad, again, my mother did go to school, finished high school. My dad didn't. Mm. He joined the army when he was 16, lying, saying that he was his brother because he wanted to leave the farming conditions that they lived under. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so, my dad had a different understanding of education, even though he read. When we came here, he assumed that we were going to be, we're going to go to school. We need, you know, books, pens. They're going to give you everything in school. And
that wasn't true.
It was not true.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I want to spend a little bit. We could spend so much time immigration alone, but I do want to, in light of the fact that you had the experience of what would be for not just an immigrant but an illegal immigrant coming mm-hmm. here, and this has been so highly politicized now, and even then it was. First of all, what would you say are one of some of the biggest misconceptions people who are hearing about illegal immigrants and things like that have about immigrants who are coming in here without papers and such things like that?
Some of it, you know, especially now, I think that one misconception is that people think that everyone's fleeing violence. And the reality is that most people are economic refugees.
Yeah.
You know, they are fleeing the economic conditions that, you know, are unbearable to a degree, mm-hmm. you know, and they're not like necessarily going hungry in the ways sometimes people portray it. But they're at the border where they're struggling every day, so they decide to leave.
Yeah.
And the other misconception is that, you know, people don't just jump the border, the wall. People come and overstay their visas.
Right.
And a lot of people from Europe do that. And that also, we all have, all immigrants have the same political interests and, you know, opinions. Mm-hmm. You know, not everyone that struggle in... you know, and ended up improving their lives is pro-immigrants. Actually, no, they're actually anti-immigrants. It's or a lot of people that are able to do better do buy into the mythology of America, and to a degree it's true because it worked for them.
Right.
But I think that very often there are circumstances and happy accidents that lead to people doing better and other people not doing so well. Mm-hmm.
Do people at the student level, whether it was in high school or even college, do people who've come here illegally do they treat people who come here illegally differently? Is there a difference there, or do people kind of don't care?
When I was in Mission High School, you know, it was kind of understood at the time that most people were illegal. So I was kind of, you know, one of those. My story was never their story. You know, I didn't, to a degree, I didn't jump a wall. I didn't have to, you know, walk the border, mm-hmm. you know, the desert. I didn't have to pay, you know, a coyote to. Mm-hmm. But the struggles here were the same. You know, living in like tight quarters and struggling to make a living, you know, dealing with the dangers of the street, the lure of the street, mm-hmm. and so yeah.
Did the street have a lure to you, or didn't?
Well, I think no, not never. But again, it has to do because my mother was very persistent in being involved in our education since mm-hmm. Guatemala, and so I kept busy. You know, I played soccer, and they supported it, and you know, with big sacrifices, because buying $80-$100 soccer shoes, shin guards, uniforms. It's a lot when someone's earning minimum wage, you know, and yeah.
I mean, since in some ways you're very much a product of the U.S. education system, at least in terms of your education, I would like to ask you some questions about that.
Yes.
You know, about public education, about ESL program, mm-hmm. And later about college. But in light of there's attacks on public education, there's defending public education, there are critiques of public education. In light of all those things that you might be aware of, what would you have to say about, as a person who's been through the system recently, what would you have to say about public education in the United States? Good, bad, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, obviously I can speak to my experience in San Francisco, mm-hmm. and you can make it up, you know, there are a few people that are the exceptional ones, I call them. And I was technically supposed to be that person, you know, this person that advances the mythology of meritocracy in this system, you know, in capitalism. And so, you know, yeah, you can go, but the reality is that most people will struggle after high school. Not everyone's gonna get that top job, you know, even if they go to college. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I remember now looking back, like we had books that were from the 90s or 80s, you know, like scientific books. Like, yes. And
old ass chemistry books.
Yeah, you know, and then like I would watch movies. You know, TV series of, you know, this idealistic, you know, high schools. And I'm like, well, where the fuck are those high schools?
Yeah. Because
I don't know any. But then, you know, when I was playing soccer, I got to meet kids that had scholarships to a university high school, which, you know, is worth like $40,000 to go to that high school. It's a private. And so, I ended up discovering things when I moved to college, mm-hmm. discovering that my experience was not the experience of everyone, and that we were shorted, you know. And again, that's when my search for answers started.
Do you want to give any specific details on that, or in terms of how you can, like, not, I don't want to go to college quite yet, but
no.
What would you say are some examples of those things that which you felt like you were not given or not put in the opportunity to, whatever.
So I think I was. Okay. I think I was, because again, I was part of this selected group that was groomed in, you know.
At our high school.
At Mission High School.
Can you say more about that? Because how, did you know that at the time, or is something you looked
at? I did. Okay. I did know it because I knew that I had certain privileges by being close to the athletic director, mm-hmm. you know, we were this, he was our coach in the soccer team, and, you know, he cared, you know, mm-hmm. he was this, Marine, you know, a guy with ex-Marine, with a tough mentality, tough love, and he cared, you know, and sometimes, you know, it was kind of not very healthy, I would say, but, you know, he cared, and he gave us the opportunity to go to soccer camps, but other kids in other, like, sports teams didn't get it right away. Eventually grew, but we were that first group of kids, and also, you know, this group of kids that were in the same honors in AP classes, we were given resources, I feel, and therefore expected us to do well.
Right.
But the rest didn't. It was the exception. It wasn't the norm.
Right.
You know, I saw kids in English, you know, ESL classes still doing the same things that I did in middle school, wasting their time as if they don't have brains, you know. But again, obviously now I understand the limitations of, you know, teachers, the capacity to be able to deal with this.
Do you want to say something about the ESL program or thoughts about that? I'm actually a teacher in the mainstream program, and I also do have an ESL class, and I can tell you it doesn't move as quickly. I do emphasize, say, learning, less learning physics and more learning English.
Yeah.
You know, but you're going through it, so what are your thoughts based on your experience? Because you actually spent some time in those programs.
I mean, obviously, if there is a way to keep, you know, learn English, but if the majority of kids speak Spanish, teach them physics in Spanish, because they shouldn't stop learning science, you know, because they don't yet know the language. It doesn't mean they're not capable of grasping concepts. On the contrary, you know, like, I think that a lot of immigrant kids, it depends. I mean, they can, you know, be as, you know, capable as anyone else. It's just that this barrier of the cultural and language barrier, in which doesn't get a lot of emphasis. It's you know, obviously an obstacle to engage in the learning, the actual learning. So I don't know how it's now. I mean, you can probably say more, but
I think it's the same program. I mean, the idea is that primarily we're trying to teach students English and get and increase their English proficiency with the seemingly the idea is that this will be a continue to be a country which is primarily English, and so their parents brought them here to speak English, so that's the sort of justification. But it does, in part, it does have the effect of meaning that students find that they're not learning as much as they could, I think, if they were learning in their native language.
Yeah,
I mean, you do have a situation now. I think there's a situation where you have a number of students coming here where they're not just learning English, they're also learning how school runs.
Yeah.
You know, because they haven't had that much, particularly when we have people coming from Central America, more and more, you know, than, say, Mexico and places like that, with this new group of immigrants coming in. You have a lot of students who don't even, it's not just that they don't know that much even in their own language about education, about math, or about Spanish or whatever language they might have been learning.
I mean, it's, I think that the, I mean, most people are coming from rural areas. I mean, there's also been an assault on public education in these countries too, so it's
not the same. I mean, I really hope to not, I don't think this interview and what you're saying here has to make you a big fan of ESL, you know? You've been through it, so I'd like to hear what those thoughts are.
It didn't, I don't think it did much for me, because it's kind of, it felt condescending. It felt like they were dumbing things down for me when I was thrown by accident, I think it was accident, I don't know, into like honors classes, and I started doing well. But again, I'm not saying that this is the norm, that everyone can just be thrown into something, but I started learning faster.
And what do you think, what about that experience of being groomed as being seen as a student, you know, one of our top star illegal or immigrant students who's gonna make it, you know? What do you feel about that? Because that continues to go on where we we identify students who are hard worker. We call yeah. hard workers. They seem like they're picking stuff up. They're
yeah.
And we're like, oh, you can make it. We're gonna kind of push you into that.
Yeah.
Tell me about what you think about that.
I mean, to me, to a degree, that to me is identity politics. That, you know, you pick these few exceptional, you know, people that for whatever reason, you know, are able to swim through this shit. It's mm-hmm. part of my mm-hmm. French. Mm-hmm. But, and then demonstrate a success and ignoring the fact that the whole system is broken and doesn't work for most. I've actually been thinking a lot about this recently, and yeah, I was that kid. I went to interviews with alumni from Harvard, you know, to, you know, very wealthy people, and I was taken to Stanford to, you know, socialize. So I was supposed to make it to these places to yeah. show that, you know, their program is working,
right.
you know, but I knew that, again, there are, you know, for every Kenny, you know, there were 20, you know, kids that weren't getting that treatment, that were yeah. being, you know, treated as if they were dumb and not yeah. capable.
Yeah, left behind.
Yeah.
And cast aside.
Yeah. yeah, and then, you know, kids that are bored end up, you know, the lure of the street, you know, like you find self-worth and value, you know, sense of belonging somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, at the time when I was, gangs were a big thing in San Francisco. I mean, gentrification has pushed them out.
Right.
But, you know, Norteños, Sureños, it was a big thing.
Right.
You know, I got beat up on 24th Street.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I always had that understanding that I wasn't better, that I was fortunate. I've always knew that, you know, my private education in Guatemala gave me something that mm-hmm. put me a little bit ahead.
Mm-hmm.
And because it was, you know, it was in big class sizes, you know, we had a personalized, you know, attention.
Right, yeah. right. And then the fact that you were good at soccer and you had a coach who cared,
yeah.
and who was going to play a very hands-on role with some of his
yeah.
players? You both. It sounds like you both liked that, but also you had mixed feelings about it.
Yeah, I mean, it was about assimilating. I think, like, I didn't. To be honest, I was also a person that was used to being told what to do and. I followed instructions and yeah. I didn't question as much as I do now,
yeah.
I would say. But that's why because I didn't fight back, I was held in good regard by a lot of people.
Right. And I think we should be clear. This is not a critique, say, of, you know, Mr. Kennedy.
Honestly,
all of us teachers fall subject to this.
Yeah.
We have all engaged in like, oh, you're the one who can make it through and we're going to help.
Yeah.
We emphasize, I've done this, you know.
Yeah.
And I think what you're kind of saying is, I think we do that, oh, I'm going to help you, and then there's going to be something that's going to come as a result of this. Maybe our energies are best put towards fighting for something that moves everyone forward as yeah. opposed to a few.
Yeah. And I mean, when you, I don't know the details, but I think that, again, when you grab exceptional people, put them in these conditions, then you can, excuse a systemic breakdown on the rest.
Right.
You know, the rest doesn't work.
Right.
And it doesn't, but, you know, it's because you're not helping it work.
Right. Right.
You know, the rest of the system. And so then we get conversations about privatization and, you know, and the market doing a better job at this,
right?
You know, rather than, you know, focusing on just uplifting the whole system.
Yes, and people will use the success of those few individuals
yeah.
who have been pushed along to then say, oh, look, the system does work if you can work hard enough.
Yeah, and like again, that. This is, to me, identity politics, the core of identity politics. These people made it, they have a seat at the table, you know, why can't you?
Mm-hmm.
You know, in perpetuating the myth of meritocracy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in this, mm-hmm. in our system.
Yeah, and it's at the root of liberal
yeah.
thought. Yeah,
yeah, and you know, and so, you know, as long as we can see someone that doesn't have the ideas that are beneficial to all of us, and they made it, it means, you know, just gotta work harder, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah.
Or change has come, and it's...
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think you're also at the same time saying don't, teachers don't help, like, don't ever help students, but don't confuse that for making any systemic change. You have to understand, it's not even a Band-Aid.
Yeah.
More likely than not, you're actually providing a service to the system that's going to say, that's going to take that work you're going to do and say, look what you've done. Oh, look, look, you know.
It's, so yeah, that makes, to me, it's charity, not change. You know, And again, just got to be careful of buying those, you know, exceptional examples.
Right. So let's go to then post high school, college.
Yes.
You go to UC Berkeley.
Yeah.
That's where you say another step forward, a major.
The biggest one, yeah.
Okay. So talk about that and what part of the journey that was for you.
Yeah. So, well, I get to Berkeley, don't know what to expect. You know, 30,000 students. I do have a full ride. I earn a scholarship. And I've always done well in school. So I get there and I find myself having to take some classes to put me up to speed to the rest, you know.
Those are just remedial classes.
Remedial classes, yeah. And to get up to speed, and, you know, that takes a hit to my ego, because here I was, you know, top of my school, that, you know, and, you know, I'm supposed to make it, I have a full ride, all these things. And the resources that I had in high school didn't follow me there.
Yeah.
And...
Can you say some of the most important resources that didn't follow?
People helping me navigate an application, or you know, or how to look for help.
Yeah.
You know, and
like that personal network you had around you.
Yeah.
Okay. Bon voyage. Good luck. You know, you've well done. We'll see you later.
Or not even, you know, knowing again any expectations or of what's to come. And so here I am. Register for classes, and find myself very alone. I do make friends, but the dominant culture at the time in Berkeley was the Chicano culture. The Chicano, and so the Central American experience is not very present.
Can you say more about what specifically you mean Chicano? Because people often confuse Chicano, Latino, you know.
So, anything that has to do with Mexico and Mexican American, because there were people that were Mexican immigrants but found, you know, a connection to, you know, the Mexican American experience, and it's everywhere. You know, they whatever Latino organizations there were, they were mainly dominated by the Chicano culture, and. So yeah, I did not feel identified. There was actually a little, going back to high school, there was always tension between Central Americans and Mexicans. So there was discrimination between the groups, you know, like often Mexican kids looked down on Central American kids because they were the dominant group.
Right.
And,
it's not true anymore.
No, Central Americans are, coming in. But, you know, still I managed to have, most of my friends were Mexican from, in high school, and in college, I did make friends from mostly Mexican American, middle class, you know. But I never developed connections. I mean, I did develop some meaningful ones, but it was always with the, you know, the understanding that they would not know how to react to my story, where I was from. Some people, some of these kids didn't even know where Guatemala is. It told you something about the system, you know, the educational system. You know, and even now, adults don't know where Guatemala is. It's more Mexico, apparently. but, yeah, so I get there. There are resources, but I feel, I don't feel connected and feel lost. You know, so I'm also expected to perform and know what the hell I'm supposed to do for the rest of my life. So I go and I want to study economics because I want to make money. And I think that's a very prevalent idea for first generation students.
Yep.
To go and make it big.
Yeah.
And to get
into
family.
Business.
Yeah, exactly. Like yeah.
Maybe and, get a business of your own. I hear that among many.
Yeah,
students.
Of course. Yeah. You know, and again.
And also among native students, often of color, but who, you know, maybe they're going to be the first generation to go to college. They'll
yeah.
often feel like, you know, getting an economics or business degree.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, you know, being filled with these expectations that if you graduate from college, you're going to make it, you know, and so start taking economics classes right away. I'm disenchanted. I'm like, you know, this is a pseudoscience, you know, this mm-hmm. is... this is like economics makes a lot of assumptions, and I'm like, what the hell is this? Like, I'm not supposed to think about that part, you know, oh, externalities, what, you know, but that's real, it affects people. So then I become disenchanted with that, and so I take, I wanted to do astronomy, but it was too much math involved, and I wasn't up to, you know.
Mm-hmm. You didn't feel like you had the background.
Yeah, exactly. And so ended up settling on politics because I've always enjoyed politics, you know, or just learning history.
Mm-hmm.
And so I pursue the major of political economy.
Mm-hmm.
It's like sort of an interdisciplinary major where you have to read philosophy, economics, political philosophy, political science, you know, to all these combination of things. And then I run into Latin American studies.
Mm-hmm.
And I started discovering a lot of things from Guatemala, from Latin America, that were not taught in high school. You know, and I do come across some, you know, left-leaning teachers. Yeah, that started
in Berkeley.
In Berkeley,
yeah.
UC Berkeley. It started shaping my understanding of politics because I didn't much question it. I just wanted to make money and do better.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to buy a house for my mother someday, and
mm-hmm.
you know, and but yeah, and you know, and then I realized too that college is not really about education. Most kids that go from good schools, they're just really there to get a degree and make connections,
mm-hmm.
ultimately, because, you know, those books are available. You can read them.
Right.
You can discuss them with people.
Right.
You know, and you're often buying professors' books, their
yeah.
books, and
yeah.
all right, sure. Or they send you to read, and you discuss it for a little bit, but in reality, you've done all the work,
mm-hmm.
you know, and just so they can grade you.
Can you say something about what are some of the... Not in, you don't have to go into great detail, but what were some of the shockers or the things that were most disturbing to you or altering for you that you learned about either Guatemala or political economy, but Latin American studies, about Latin
yeah.
American politics or, you know?
Yeah. Just the degree of connection, because I had always known that the U.S. intervened in Guatemala. That was kind of I think I learned that at an early age,
yeah.
in 1954, after they tried to a president tried to implement a land reform to modernize the economy. He wasn't even a socialist, you know,
right.
But he was just trying to modernize a feudal system to have more economic actors right in an economy. But just understanding that, oh, like that coup came from Honduras, and then, you know, and then I learned about Nicaragua, and oh, the Contras came from Honduras too. So what's going on in Honduras? Oh, there's a U.S. military base, you know, and then they also supported terrorism in El Salvador,
mm-hmm.
you know, and learning about the School of the Americas that the U.S. taught torture.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so I started, you know, I never put the U.S. in a pedestal. It was always in the background that the U.S. had done some horrible things, especially going back to the revolutionary music, you know, that taught me.
That your mom listened
yeah,
to. Yeah.
You know, you hear in the songs people talking about losing the mountains because we're selling a ton of iron for 25 cents and, you know, water and this. And so I've always known, but just diving deeper, you know, and yeah, the extent of the violence that the U.S. supported. But I didn't never made that connection of, you know, capitalism in the U.S. is just a bad government. Mm-hmm. So I never delve into capitalism because I wanted to be a capitalist. Yeah. I wanted to be, you know, a business person, mm-hmm. you know, and I never questioned that, those ideas.
Right.
Not yet.
Right. And so where does that then take you from there, like in terms of these classes?
Yeah.
What's next for you?
So I took, you know, development studies classes. So I come across, you know, Marx, Gramsci, you know, a lot of political philosophers, and just, you know, this idea that certain people have shaped the world because of their ideas. You know, Adam Smith, you know, I've read all this stuff, but I didn't sink in. It was kind of just like, you know, I gotta do this, all right? It wasn't personal. Mm-hmm. I didn't put one and one together. And so inevitably I faced some of my darkest years. I, you know, on a personal note, almost committed suicide because mm-hmm. of that. Because I feel...
You're in college?
In college. Time?
Okay.
Because I can't fail, you know. I have so many people that have put, you know, resources behind me. They have expectations. My mother has expectations, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, why am I failing? You know, I'm supposed to make it.
Yeah.
And, you know, not having people that understood this. And so I decided one day, you know, I'm done. I don't want this. Like, what the fuck? I gotta live a life. Mm-hmm. And I remember talking to my brother, and he, you know, my brother has his own journey as a mainly thrown into the labor force right away. I am sometimes pick up, you know, I used to work in restaurant jobs during college, but I didn't have to because I had a full ride, I had support. And then, but my brother, you know, who at the time I was, to be honest, I looked down, you know, and that's when I was started, I think, assimilating a lot of these expectations and of the ideas of knowing better because I went to college.
Right.
And that's when I started to become a liberal, you know, like a Democrat. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, absorbing all the sound bites, you know, rallying behind Obama. When I was in college, I went to Obama's inauguration because a friend was doing an internship in Congress. Mm-hmm. So she got us tickets. I flew out there and then started interacted with people in the political scene, you know, like the aides and other interns, and realized the trash that, you know, that whole system is. And, you know, and it's all show in like a high school pageant sort of thing. Yeah, because we were there around the inauguration ball, and people just dropping names and this and that. And so at that time, I had already made a transition. I wanted to go into politics, mm-hmm. you know, somehow, you know. So I was studying political economy. I was going to apply that and, you know, change the world mm-hmm. that way. And but I realized that, you know, it was nothing of what I expected, you know.
Can you say more also about, because in some ways, the very same period you're describing, this college period, as both having this radicalizing effect,
yeah.
It also seems to be the time when you're becoming a more dyed-in-the-wool liberal in some ways.
Yes.
So can you talk about how that's not a contradiction? Like, how are both those things connected? Or how do you, because some people might say, well, wait, didn't he just a second ago say he's becoming more radical? But at the same time, in many ways, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think I understand. Yeah, I mean, that was what was around, you know, one of the reasons that Berkeley lured me in was because this, you know, civil rights fights were, you know, there was a time where Berkeley was, you know, an activist, you know, ground zero, and people stood up for something.
Yeah.
And, you know, I get there and it's none of that, you know, at least not what I expected.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot of people just trying to go into tech, you know, because that's where it's going to be, or,
mm-hmm.
you know, and, you know, realizing that the things that I'm interested in are not going to pay off.
Mm-hmm.
And, but yeah, I mean, so I didn't see the radicalism, but I did buy the whole binary of Republicans are bad, Democrats are good, or at least better.
Yeah.
You know, at least,
yeah.
which is one of my the phrases I hate the most now, at least right. the Democrats are better.
Right.
And so...
We heard that last episode.
Yeah.
And Brandy was thinking I'm giving Eduardo a hard time.
You know. And so I did. I bought it. You know, and so, you know, I bought this whole idea that if only people knew better, you know, if only people were more educated, if, you know, they would know better, they would do better. So, you know, and obviously now I'm in a different place, and where if you spend time talking to people, you know that people know.
Yeah.
You know, they may not have the fancy words, but they understand how the system works, you know. And, you know, to a degree, obviously. But, you know, I was talking down to people. I found myself isolated from my family, you know, a bit, in part because of that. Because mm-hmm. I wanted to tell them what to do.
Right.
Tell
right.
them how to be better people. And,
And so at this point, in some ways, you're becoming more like elitist
yeah.
a little bit. But it's also connected to becoming more unhappy.
Yes. I mean, yeah, you know, so, yeah, I that is true. I wasn't unhappy because I just felt that in order to get what I wanted, that I knew, I had to become someone I didn't want to become.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like, I think since that time I understood that to make money, you know, yeah, either you get lucky, you're the biggest son of a gun there is,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I've always understood that. And, but I still bought until recently, really the last couple of years, bought this idea that you can be a benevolent, rich person, you know, mm-hmm. billionaire. And,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and can you say more about how do you understand what brought you to that crossroads where you're thinking of killing yourself? Because it sounds like that is a very important point where something was going to have to, you were going to go one way
yeah.
or another. Can you say a little bit more about what brought you there and then how that resolved it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I finished what my brother told me, but...
Oh, okay.
No, it's fine. I mean, but again, I'm dealing with a lot of expectations, not a lot of success because I wasn't motivated. You know, I wasn't, I didn't know what I wanted. You know, and here I was 21, 22, 20, having to know what I wanted after having just arrived into the country,
mm-hmm.
you know, and expected to become this great economic actor, right? Again, you know, mm-hmm. provider of sorts and fulfilling the hopes of other people and feeling like a failure.
Yeah.
And so, you know, then I remember having like long rides on BART just to waste, you know, time and
just driving
just,
on
just
it.
Yeah. yeah. And then, yeah. Eventually sum up the courage or whatever energy to say, you know, I don't want this anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember talking to my brother. I remember the street. I remember the place. And he told me one simple thing is like, Kenny, you know, no one else can live your life.
Mm-hmm.
Only you can live your life and it's your own mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
And so that like changed my world. And I remember thinking I need to pull to the side. You know, I'm driving. I don't know where the hell I'm going. I feel like I have a bunch of cars behind me that I have to leave.
Right.
And then
everyone's honking.
Yeah. Or, you know, or I don't want him to honk. You
yeah.
know,
yeah.
I don't want him to honk because, you know, and then I pulled to the side and I said, I'm done. I dropped out.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it's the best thing I did for me. Because, I mean, there are many people that I went to school with that did graduate, and they're not very much better than I am.
Mm.
You know, and I'm not, I don't, you know, I...
Economically,
yes. Yeah. I mean, they may have a job that earns better, but they're $100,000 in debt.
Mm-hmm.
or, you know, or miserable, because mm-hmm. that's what they chose and they have to do, mm-hmm. you know. And so I don't know, it's not a, again, a critique on them as much as it's on the system. I dropped out, didn't finish. I faced a lot of shit from people, a lot of shame. You know, I hid in, you know, I felt like a failure, even though that was my choice. I did feel like a failure.
Yeah.
And, you know, worked in restaurants, I still do. But, you know, I've been happy. You know, I took chances, moved to Nicaragua.
Yeah. I guess I want to go back to that point where you made that decision, because I don't remember, I do remember when you made that decision, and I do remember having questions about it. What were our conversations at that point in time?
I don't think we had a close relationship. Okay. You know, I don't think you were very prominent in my life. Mm-hmm. You were more in Hamlet's life. Yeah. That's how we stayed in touch. But, no, I don't remember. And again, I remember hiding. I didn't want to talk about it.
Yeah.
You know, but obviously that feeling of shame, you know, followed me for years.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. But, you know, then.
So next, you make that decision and you're like, you say, I'm leaving that behind. I'm leaving that whole thing that was somebody else's dream almost.
Yeah.
And also I hear you saying that if I follow this road down, then if for me to be successful at it, I'm going to have to become somebody I don't want to become.
Yeah.
So you basically stood away from that
sort
of situation. And then what's the course then?
Well, you know, I met someone.
Yeah.
You know, we got together. And then we moved. We struggled. You know, we mm-hmm. went, we lived together. We paid for, you know, an apartment. We were both just spinning the wheels, you know, working two jobs. Mm-hmm. And also like, they do live in the, you know, a life outside our means. You know, I think now in retrospective, you know, filling some gaps, some things that were missing. And, but eventually we decided, you know, this is not working, this ship is sinking.
Yeah.
And moving to Nicaragua. And, you know, getting a house there, pursuing the American dream down there. You know,
pursuing the American dream in Nicaragua.
Yeah. Like a house, you know, a good job, you know, comfort, right? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, that didn't work out for many reasons. Economic, mm-hmm. you know, it's a part of it. You know, the economic pressures and the expectations that don't get met. And then, you know, I kept reading, obviously, during this time, always on the news, trying to understand the world, discover things.
And how would you, what are you learning during that period?
So, I mean, learning more about history, but the main thing is that I got to Nicaragua, a socialist, democratic, Christian country. That's what they call themselves, the government.
Right.
And learning, like, insider information of how the government operated. And
the Sandinista
leftists that, you know, at one time I kind of like, you know, like a lot of, I would say, somewhat liberal people, you know, they stood up against, you know, but then I was criticizing, you know, what was happening because it was full of corruption. Mm-hmm. And then I, you know, seeing the capital business aspect, you know, entangled with all this, you know, with the ruling class. And I started, you know, basically I came to the conclusion that it was the same shit. Mm-hmm. You know, this is no, you know, and then I started questioning socialism. Mm-hmm. You know, and I mean, I never bought it. I never, because I bought those ideas, you know, like Stalin and, you know, and Cuba, you know, even though like to a degree I romanticized Cuba. I also didn't like the fact that, you know, this government didn't allow people to leave and all these things. And so, yeah, I live in Nicaragua, but I know that this is trash. The government is trash. And, you know, I remember talking to Hema and like saying that one day shit is going to hit the fan, because I could see that, you know, there were a lot of kids, you know, that, or not kids, but young people, educated people that didn't have prospects, you know, and the only way to advance in this system was to be part of the party.
Right.
One party system.
Yeah.
And sure enough.
Or to be part of a family connected to the party and things like
that. Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, people that were in positions of power, you know, being pressured to do shady things, to get kickbacks, you know, for example. And that's just the way it is. And, you know, but at the same time, you know, that I talked to some of these people, realizing that they didn't have, they never questioned, you know, the system. Mm-hmm. Or they, at least they stayed quiet. And, but now in retrospective, there wasn't much socialism. There wasn't, you know, many worker unions or anything that, yeah.
And so what happens then? Does that get us to where the is the next thing going to be the Nicaraguan uprising?
Yes.
That took place?
Okay. So then, you know, come back to the U.S., Nicaragua, you know, the repression starts, you know, after, you know, the economic...
And this is back in April of last year.
Yes. Yeah. And so things, I think that's kind of the last maybe stage that has led me to where I'm now, realizing how, you know, the lies, you know, from the left, the lies from capitalism, obviously, the entanglement of these two.
Particularly because you heard there were leftists here in this country who were defending Daniel Ortega as some sort of like,
and I remember the time that, you know, you had questions that you didn't know exactly what to say, but, you know, because we had connections to the ground, we knew that, you know, hospitals were being closed, that repression was happening. It wasn't even, you know, through social media, which, you know, it was exaggerated on both sides, manipulation from both sides, you know, exaggerations. But, you know, understanding, because, you know, I guess I'm asking for permission from Emma here, but she worked in the private sector, mm-hmm. and understanding the connection of capital and power and the pact that the, you know, basically the owners of the country had, that pact broke down when, you know, when Ortega was, people rose up, the pact of the capitalist class and the government broke down because they said, okay, someone else is coming in. He's on his way out.
Yeah.
So they, but I mean, it was a school. Nicaragua was a school for many reasons, you know, seeing people organize, you know, in solidarity with one another, figuring stuff out on the fly, you know. They didn't have a plan, the exact plan, but they figured stuff out. Also, the whole issue of guns, you know, Nicaragua, it's illegal to have guns, basically. Like, you know, and then when students and people rose up, they got dismantled. There was no way they could win.
Yeah.
You know, without fighting back. They resisted, but, you know, that made me question this idea of gun control, because I was part of the Liberal Democrats. So, you know, guns are bad, and, you know, and the problem is that we have too many guns, you know, and rather than looking, you know, at guns as... at the source of violence, not guns, but the ideas, the economic pressures behind them, mm-hmm. you know. And... so that was a school. I also learned about the AOS, Organization of American States.
Yeah.
They're flip-flopping. You know, the U.S. Also, you know, not very interested in Nicaragua. You know, the media coverage wasn't anything, you know. Mm-hmm. And then also... learning about the naive expectations of some people expecting the United Nations blue helmet, you know,
to come in
force
and
to come in and
help or something.
Yeah, or people too expecting the military in Nicaragua to you know, overthrow Ortega. But, you know, I kept saying at the time, they're in the same bed. They're the same thing. They're together.
Yeah.
You know, so, and they're pro-capital. Mm-hmm. You know, they are capitalists. They just mm-hmm. call themselves socialists. Mm-hmm. You know, and, yeah, I mean, I don't know if you have any particular questions on that, but...
Well, I think, what do you feel like about that entire experience made you make that break from liberal to revolutionary? And you saw all these bad socialisms, but now you call yourself a socialist.
Yes.
So those are two questions.
Yes, so I personally don't call that socialism. It's not. And I think that that's a problem we have on the left. You know, that, yeah, you know, it's, you can maybe call it state socialism,
mm-hmm.
you know, just like in state communism. And, mm-hmm. but, you know, so that, I started reading more stuff. I dove back into Marx, into, you know, talk to you about some stuff, mm-hmm. you know, like, Rosa Luxemburg, mm-hmm. and I remember reading Daniel De Leon, you know, Reformer Revolution, mm-hmm. and, really diving into these ideas. What is revolution? You know, like, and rather than just the things that I've been fed. And so, you know, because while Nicaragua was happening in the midst of that, I kept saying, you know, if anything, they should be pushing to the left, because this is not the left, you know, and that was a mistake. And so they lacked political identity in the movement, that they were resisting something. But I do believe that they don't realize that they're resisting the same forces, you know, that mm-hmm. have gripped this world, you know, and so I just wanted to know more. You know, I've always been somewhat involved, but I wanted to understand more of what it means to be a socialist, because I knew Ortega wasn't.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, you know, and I had an idea that I've been.
Can you try to answer that question today, or like? Do you have an answer to that question, or do you have a partial answer to that?
What is socialism?
What does it mean to be a socialist?
Yeah, I do think. I mean, I obviously I'm still learning and changing, but ultimately, to me, it boils down to, you know, believing in the democracy, the power of the working class. You know, the power of the base of society to decide what the rest of society looks like. And I mean, put simply, like you and I have talked about it, the dictatorship of the working class,
mm-hmm.
you know, and you know, it comes from the understanding, at least for now, that if people can change their own lives, you know, by getting more of that pie, you know, they can be more active in pursuing other things,
mm-hmm.
you know. So. Yeah, I mean, socialist to me is democracy. It's, mm-hmm. it's, you know, democracy of the people that produce mm-hmm. the things, you know, because, you know, we don't need a Bezos to run Amazon, for example.
You, so that probably led you to, you know, like, it led you away from the Democratic Party. But now we have, like, the Democratic Socialists of America, mm-hmm. and we have, potentially, they talk about this group organization being 50,000 socialists. You know, what are your feelings about something like that taking place now in America? Does that give you hope? Does that, like, how do you feel about the DSA, their leaders?
Yeah,
these people who are you know, considering themselves, who are giving socialism a new look, because mm-hmm. they're saying that they're part of DSA.
Yeah.
What are your feelings about that? Because there are people who are very excited about that, even if they have criticisms of it.
Yeah. I mean, again, I'm still learning. I don't fully understand the Democratic Socialist Party. I know Bernie Sanders and Ocasio-Cortez are not socialism, because, again, I see socialism as a movement from the bottom up. And, you know, how do we get there? Obviously, there are questions. I do believe that obviously this helps, mm-hmm. hopefully, you know, mm-hmm. to talk about it. But, yeah, I mean, I think we have to be careful, obviously, that we got to be careful of being led to a dead end, you know, because that was something I learned throughout, you know, my disenchantment with Obama. you know, when I started learning that he was deporting the most people ever,
right?
You know, that he was bombarding people,
and the drone strikes,
yeah. And then making war on, you know, journalism, mm-hmm. you know, or like persecuting journalists for the, you know, to know their sources.
Going after whistleblowers.
Yeah, whistleblowers and all that. And so, you know, I realized that it's a systemic thing, you know, even if some benevolent person, you know, they're just placeholders, you know, and in the service of capital, you know, in the service of companies. Because we don't benefit from bombing someone, you know,
right,
like,
right.
And, you know, so yeah, I mean, again, I've been in the last year, I've wrestled with this idea of reform or revolution. You know, I started talking to you about it. And what does that mean? You know, and I do think that some of these groups are reformists. You know, they think that they can make capitalism more benevolent. Mm-hmm. They can hold it down, you mm-hmm. know, like a beast. And maybe this is something that people want to read, you know, Daniel De Leon's explanation of reform versus revolution. But understanding that, you know, we're in a situation that capitalism creates, is not that it went in you know, astray, is that it's its natural progression, you know, to where we are. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so it's a little bit naive, at least for me, to think that you can restrain it. Mm-hmm. So it has to be taken down, especially, again, yes, I do think that the future is bleak for my generation or for those behind me, because we have other constraints now mm-hmm. that are rapidly approaching.
Well, this question might be, I'm curious what you'd say here, because one of the critiques I've run into, and I'm curious as a person who's from Guatemala, mm-hmm. is that Marxism or these ideas are European ideas, mm-hmm. and that, you know, in many ways, but either they're European ideas,
yeah.
and or they're old ideas. We need new ideas, and we need new ideas that fit actually the people who are going to be doing the struggle. What do you think of that critique? Good, bad, you know, just what do you say about that?
Well, you know, again, I still have to learn about other people from Latin America, but still, to me, it boils down to a simple thing. The dominant system is capitalism. Whether it started in Europe or another place, it doesn't even matter. We have it on top of us.
Globally.
Yeah. And so, yes, it's an old system. It has built itself from previous, you know, economic forms of sustaining life. You know, yes, there are elements of sexism that arose in agricultural societies because mm-hmm. the man was the dominant mm-hmm. economic figure. Mm-hmm. Then, you know, obviously colonialism. I mean, I'm not going to deny these things exist. But if we are to have a chance at, you know, at beating this system and making fundamental change, it's going to take a lot of us. It's going to take the people that are most affected. And so, again, that's why I also, like, we didn't talk about identity politics, but until up to 2 years ago, I was buying that. I was biting into that sandwich. I was. And, you know, but I was never convinced because I thought it had limitations. Never really examined it because I was being reactive, mm-hmm. you know. But then, you know, and I always heard it. Honestly, I disagreed with you, mm-hmm. you know. But then I come across, you know, the book Rigoberta Menchú, an indigenous woman in Guatemala, mm-hmm. who struggled against capitalism from a Christian leftist, whatever. You should probably read it, but she brings up this issue of identity politics in Guatemala, of being the reason that the working people can't fight the capitalists, because, you know, that seeing that, you know, that, you know, Ladinos, non-indigenous people, were as poor as indigenous people, but they still felt superior, you know, the racial bribe, and Michelle Alexander quotes this
right.
in, you know, The New Jim Crow.
Yeah.
But, you know, Rigoberta Menchú understanding that, you know, that you know, that that is a big obstacle. And then realizing that we're doubling down on this shit.
Yeah.
You know, that we want to fight, you know, in prejudice with prejudice, you know, that, you know, this idea that because you look a certain way, you have the same experience for starters,
right, right.
You know, and that, you know, and that's why I mean that, you know, not all Latinos are Democrats or right. liberals or care about immigration.
Some of them don't want immigrants coming across.
Yeah. You know, people that migrated here.
Yeah.
People in my family voted for Trump, you know,
right.
I say,
right.
And so again, and that led me to that conclusion that in order to make change, you know, democratic change, you know, in this world, we will have to overcome that shit. And I will never maybe even agree on certain values with people when we can agree that we are working class,
yeah.
that we have to get up, go make a living, you know, that we're being screwed by, you know, these people, understanding that, you know, poor white Americans that are struggling, they're like, privilege, fuck you, you know, like, privilege, I'm struggling here.
Right, right.
You know, and that, so understanding that some of the ideas that the Republicans, at least Trump, you know, parade, they are leftist ideas. They should be leftist ideas. You know, like, why would I want to pay more taxes to this fucking, you know, government?
Mm-hmm.
Or why would I want to give up my guns when, you know, you're militarizing the police?
Correct.
You know? So, but that doesn't make me a Republican, you know? Like, but it seems that there is the potential of amassing people
right.
across this binary of Democrat, Republican.
Mm-hmm. But you also see how identity politics have
oh, yeah.
are incapable of uniting.
Yes, I mean, I do think that obviously, you know, these things we've inherited from previous economic systems will not disappear magically. They will have to get addressed, and they get addressed. You know, last night actually, I happened to talk to a coworker, and he is probably dismissed as this machista, you know, Mexican man, you know, who was a military man. And I learned so much. He was part of a union fight in Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And he lost his job eventually, but he stood up for two women that were being harassed.
Right.
You know, but identity politics will tell you that he is not worth it. He's
right.
done.
Right.
You know, that he has nothing to provide. But in the struggle, you know, against the capitalists, he stood up for justice. And people are capable of that.
Yeah.
You know, because mm-hmm. as long as we understand that, you know, respect that fact that we have to make a living, mm-hmm. you know, and that we're in the same fight, like, I don't care what religion you're from,
right.
you know, or
right.
I don't care where you came from.
Right. You have to, I mean, and I think that solidarity is based on the fact that we are actually in the same shithole, even if it's, we have different levels of shit covering us kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's not just something that's in your mind. It's actually a situation we live in. Like there are people who are oppressing us, and we are bound with each other as people who are part of that, experiencing all these different types of oppression.
Yeah.
And exploitation.
Yeah.
Which is what binds the working class. It's not just an idea of being friends with one another. It's actually we have a class interest
yeah.
in being together.
Yeah, and I mean, but I think it will be necessary to understand and see these, you know, these things that separate us, you know, as a tool,
yeah.
you know, whether it was, you know, accidentally created or not, it's a tool, you
yeah.
know, and it's there and it's dividing us and keeping us from, you know, reclaiming power
right.
or claiming power.
Right. And unless we do overcome it, we will never be successful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then might as well go back to your trench and
right.
dig in.
right.
And shoot whoever comes their way.
That's right.
I mean, yeah.
So you're a socialist, a revolutionary socialist today. What would you say has been the biggest, what would you say about that, about being that, like living that life today? And what would you say about what you feel you have to do, or even other people have to do going forward, to try to make something actually happen?
obviously they construct a lot of the, you know.
But first, maybe say something about what it's been like for you living that life. Because for me, sometimes it's very isolating. Sometimes I feel like I'm crazy. It can be very hard. So I guess I want to hear you talk a little about that.
I mean, I'm starting my road, you know, there. I definitely find myself, like, there's people that dodge me now, you know, they don't want to engage, or they automatically shut down a conversation. I've actually had people, like, scream on my face, you're the problem, you're the reason, you know, you voted for Trump, you know, liberals, you know, people that, you know, or I've had people cut me off because I challenged them back. And, you know, because again, they fall back into their identity politics. And, you know, and so yeah, I mean, it can be isolating, but I've also gained stuff. You know, I have people that want to engage, you know, because I'm open about it. You know, we talked about it, this in the last episode, you know, and people, inquiring into why, you know, and because sometimes they're thrown off when I say no, fuck Cuba or fuck, you know, the Soviet, you know, like the Stalin and them. Like, it's not, I don't call that socialism, you know, and, you know, or fuck Ortega, you know, because I think a lot of, I don't know, liberal Democrats tend to romanticize some of these things.
Yeah, and the left has made a tendency to defend, you know, regimes which are not socialist, but that the United States is pushing on them. And sometimes we tend to paint those regimes almost in red colors, even though what they're just doing is defending themselves. And there's no working class democracy there.
Exactly.
But their right to defend themselves from the U.S. imperialism, absolutely.
Yeah. And so, again, that I've learned that, you know, if there is there working class democracy, asking different questions. And, you know, but I've also, I don't know, it's, again, it's relatively new. And I am a revolutionary socialist because I do believe that, you know, we need to flip that power dynamic, you know, and that is revolution. You know, that's how I understand it right now with, you know, again, Daniel De Leon's Reform and Revolution is the one thing that kind of cemented it for me. I mean, I'm not afraid, really, like, maybe I'm naive, I don't know, but I think that I want to be honest, you know, and I don't know, and that's kind of like, maybe, I don't know if we have time, but that's kind of the questions that I had for you, you know, like, why do you do this?
Well, that's for another episode.
I know, but I want to...
I have one more question for you, sorry. So what's next then for you? Instead of saying, oh, what should the left do? I want to actually talk, put it just in terms, what do you see for yourself now? There's such a trajectory your own life has gone, you know. What do you feel like, where do you feel like you have to take yourself next?
Well, I obviously have to keep learning, and, but also put it into practice, you know, you know, that I do believe, you know, that in the collective, you know, ability of working people to change, transform, you know, in simple things like, you know, my mother has a union and, you know, like we talk and I'm like, Mom, like if you fight for a better wage, it has a domino effect. It transforms society. You know, in you know, because the competitors are gonna have to raise their wages because there is not enough people that want to do that job for minimum wage, and so I don't know. But I think that at least that's what I think in the short term. Putting myself in that position, where I am in a situation where I have some skin in the game, you know, and so that means getting a union job somewhere, and probably means challenging the union leadership.
Oh, hell yeah.
You know, and you know, fighting this idea that a union is a membership club, you know, just like that you pay fees to.
That fighting that idea among the union, from the union leadership, and honestly from the union membership.
Yeah.
So, Well, I'm thinking, I do know you have some questions, and I'm thinking this has been kind of, can you see the
1:30?
Time? Oh, so this is perfect.
Yeah. Know,
I think since Eduardo's going to be back next 2 weeks, maybe what we'll do, because we still need some more episodes, we'll see, maybe who knows what's going to happen in the world. Maybe what we will do is come back and you'll have some questions for me, you know, based on some of that. We'll see.
We'll see.
Does that work for you?
Yeah.
Okay. Is there anything else you feel like we should be touching on in terms of kind of understanding where Kenny came from and how can we, you know, and where you are now?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think maybe we'll do this episode some other time, in a year from now.
We covered the first pass.
Because I mean, I understand, you know, I'm learning, I'm still starting to learn how to walk in this, you know, as a socialist, you know, so we'll see. And
it's interesting to me that I don't hear you trying to find an organization. I don't see you saying, like, I'm looking for an organization. I don't hear that, right?
No, I mean, because I think I've heard it stories, you know?
Okay.
You, Brian, and other people, and, you know, maybe, I don't know, that might be also a next step, and, you know, to bring my own opinions and learn from other people.
I'm not saying that is, interesting. A lot of times when people find that, they got to find an organization. But it's almost like you're not thinking that way.
But it's not. But I think it's, for me, it's about, like, how I'm that person talking to everyone. Because this is, what I'm saying is nothing, you know, it's not rocket science.
Yeah.
You know, when we talk about the things that are happening, the dynamics, the power, it's not rocket science. It shouldn't just belong to an organization.
Yeah.
It ultimately has to be in the hands of the working people.
Yeah.
And so if they want to call it something else, you know, whatever. But, you know, if the fundamentals are there, if you want working class power, you know, then welcome.
Well, I can hear my roommates, too.
Yeah.
I guess we'll call it a day then. Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
This has been really instructive for me to see that you kind of got yourself to these various points where you could not continue in that way any longer.
Yeah.
And you had to make all these different places where you had to kind of make backing up and go a different direction in your life to kind of get you to where
you are. That's a good metaphor.
So, thank you. We'll be back next week. It'll probably likely be myself and Eduardo talking about his experiences in France. I'll be interviewing him about what's going on in France right now, and hopefully he's talking to people in the Yellow Vest movement and the general strike going on there. We'll see. Or maybe it's Spain is next week. I think it's Spain actually next week. For those of you who are listening, if you want to catch more of our episodes, right, you can catch us on YouTube. Eduardo does this, so I'm iTunes, Stitcher, BitChute. And definitely, send us your comments, write the bell notification, right, to tell us on YouTube, or subscribe, write a review. That would really help us on iTunes. If you have thoughts about this episode or any of our previous episodes, and other than that, I guess we'll see you next week. You'll be definitely seeing more of this guy in the coming weeks and the rest of the months and, you know, as long as we do what's left. All right, thanks, Kenny.
Well, thank you.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.